University of Louisville, a psychologist by the name of Michael Cunningham, did an extensive study a few years ago of the most common complaints that men and women, or husbands and wives, have about each other. The most common complaints. And here's what he discovered. The most common complaints that husbands have about wives include the silent treatment, bringing up past transgressions, being too hot or too cold, being critical, and being stubborn and refusing to give in. That's what husbands complained about their wives, or men complained about women. All right, ladies, the most common complaints that women had about their husbands: forgetting important dates, not working hard enough, burping or passing gas, staring at other women, and being stubborn and refusing to give in. Now, aside from the particulars there, there's a common denominator in both of those, isn't there? Notice, being stubborn and refusing to give in. We won't talk about some of the other complaints that are up there. It is human nature to be stubborn and refuse to give in all relationships, but it, you know, marriage does not create problems. It works like a magnifying glass to magnify whatever those issues are that we have with one another. And so, especially in marriage, it becomes very, very, very much a part of our debates, our arguments with one another. It is human nature to fight for our self-interest, even with those people we love. We want our own way. Pride destroys relationships, and Jesus came to change all of that. The Bible teaches us that Christ reverses our relationships. Human nature teaches us to think, you know, me first, you second. Christ reverses that order in our relationships. And Paul in Philippians chapter 2 challenges us along those lines. He challenges us to put others first, to live for others rather than ourselves. And that's the key to healthy relationships. Whether it's in a marriage, or whether it's in our friendships, or whether it's in a church body, we have to think right about ourselves and about others before we can have healthy relationships. So, we start by thinking right about ourselves. Principle number one: how we think about ourselves can hurt others. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 3. Paul writes in that opening clause, "Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit." Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. He goes on to say, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. The New American Standard, of course, says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. If you have a King James, it reads, let nothing be done through strife or vainglory. Now, the verb is not in the original Greek text. There's no verb here in the original Greek text. We have to supply it. That's not terribly uncommon in the New Testament, where we have to supply a word that they expect to be understood. Now, the translators here in this version supplied the verb to do something. So they say, do nothing from selfishness or conceit. Probably better in the context, because usually you want to supply the verb, the last main verb that was used in the Greek text. And the last main verb used in the Greek text, as you read it through, is the word to think, or to be like-minded. So it's probably better to supply the word to think here. What we think about ourselves translates into actions, of course. But the key is in the thinking. The battle in all relationships takes place first in the mind. So we are to think nothing according to selfishness. Or another version says, according to strife. The word means contentiousness. It means selfish ambition. And it's the same word used back in Philippians chapter 1:17. If you remember back when we were talking about that verse in the context where the preachers in the city of Rome, the pastors, were actually preaching out of selfish ambition against Paul, who was in prison. He was awaiting trial before Emperor Nero as he writes these words. So Paul was in prison, and the others were preaching out of selfishness or empty conceit, this selfish ambition, criticizing Paul, who was in prison. Now, in Russia, I was asked to speak at a pastor's conference on the Saturday that I was there in Orensburgskaya Oblast, which is basically the province of Orensburg, or sort of like the state of Orensburg. And so they'd gathered the pastors and their wives, and they'd asked me to speak at this pastor's conference, and they had given me a topic. And the topic was, how do churches and Christians get along with one another when they don't agree? I said, thank you very much for that topic. But I'm well versed in that topic, because it's not just in Russia that you have that problem. We have the same problem in America. It's a huge issue, isn't it? How do churches and Christians get along when they don't agree? And I talked to them about Paul's experience in Philippians chapter 1 when he's in the Roman jail, and the other pastors and the other churches are preaching out of selfish ambition and criticizing him. And the terribly destructive effect that had upon the testimony of Jesus Christ. It is so easy to fall into the trap of contentiousness. We can engage in petty squabbling over all kinds of minor issues. We can become quarrelsome. That's this word. That's our human nature. Well, Jesus came to change our selfish natures. But all too often, as Christians, we slide right back into the ways of sin, whether it's in a church or in our relationships with others who are in other churches, we slide right back into it. Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 20, "For because I am afraid," he says, "that perhaps when I come, I may find you to be not what I wish, and may be found by you to be not what you wish, that perhaps there may be strife." That's this word, selfish ambition. "Perhaps there may be strife, jealousy, angry tempers, disputes, slanders, gossip, arrogance, disturbances." Now, who's Paul talking about? He's talking about the Christians. He's not talking about the people out there. He's talking about the people in church. And this is indeed the worst part of church life, is it not? I mean, let's be honest. We do not always treat one another right, though we profess to follow Jesus Christ. And we go to church and we look good. And Paul is talking about Christians. He's talking about people in the church and how they treat one another. He says, I don't want to come and hear of this. And one of those ways that we treat one another is this selfish ambition. We display all of these tendencies in our relationships with one another. And we do it when selfishness takes root in our thinking. Where does selfishness come from? Where does this selfish ambition that is part of our human nature, where does it come from? Strife is the symptom of a deeper problem. I mean, if you're going to diagnose something spiritually, you need to go to the root of the problem and not just deal with the symptoms. The symptoms are selfish ambition, trying to get ahead at other people's expenses. Paul goes on to say we are to think nothing out of, second word is empty conceit. And there's the root. The root is pride. The Greek word means to have an exaggerated self-perception. Just pride. We think highly of ourselves. It can even mean a delusion. We are delusional in our thinking because we have exaggerated self-conceptions, self-perceptions. We think too highly of ourselves. And that leads to selfish ambition, which leads to the arguments and the fights. the authors of the book, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. Yeah, that's the title. They argue that our tendency to justify our actions is more powerful and deceptive than an explicit lie. Now, we know lying is wrong. But self-justification is more damaging, they said, to relationships than outright lies. It allows people to convince themselves that what they did was the best they could have done. In fact, come to think of it, well, given the circumstances, it was the right thing to do. Self-justification is always ultimately delusional, but we are very good at it. So, there was nothing else I could have done in this situation, becomes the statement. Actually, it was a brilliant solution considering the circumstances. Yeah? Hear the self-justifying talk? I was doing the best for the family, the marriage, the nation. Politicians are great at self-justifying. Those people deserved what they got, after all. I'm entitled. I deserve. These are all self-justifying words or phrases. They said, for example, they went around and they tried this little test with marriages. They would ask husbands and wives what percentage of the housework they did, that is, the work around the house. And the wives would respond, "Are you kidding? I do 90% of it. I do it. It's me." And the husbands would respond, "Well, you know, I do quite a lot. I do maybe 40%. Well, try adding 90 and 40, and what do you get?" And they said in every single case, it was way more than 100%. I mean, the numbers may vary between the two people, but it was always way more than 100%. They said it's tempting to conclude that one spouse is lying, that it's false. But it's far more likely that each is remembering in ways that enhance the value of their contributions. See, that's self-justifying. It's not an outright lie. We really think that because we're remembering differently. And they write these words. Over time, as the self-serving distortions of memory kick in, we come to believe our own lies little by little. We know we did something wrong, but we gradually begin to think that it wasn't our fault. And after all, the situation was complex. We start underestimating our own responsibility, whittling away at it until it is a mere shadow of its former hulking self. Ever experience or ever practice self-justifying talk? I think we all do. It's because of that inflated opinion we have of ourselves. And the solution, Paul says, is humility in this verse. We are to think nothing out of selfish ambition or exaggerated self-perception, but... And here's the contrast in the verse. We are to think with humility. Every time we come to a dispute, we should start with humility. One writer puts it this way: ego builds a cardboard fortress that humility must every day tear down. We are good at building those cardboard fortresses of who we are, of our self-image, our self-opinion, and humility must tear that down. And it must do so every single day. That is a constant daily process of life. It's not like we can say someday, you know, "Well, I finally arrived, I'm now humble." Yeah, that doesn't work. When situations trigger our selfish pride, we erupt like a volcano, and the result is destroyed relationships. So how we think about ourselves can hurt other people. But we must replace that selfishness, that exaggerated self-perception, with humility. And how do we do that? Well, Paul goes on to tell us how to be humble. In verse 3, second principle, when we value others, that's when we humble ourselves, when we value others. Look what he said. Do nothing, think nothing, really, from selfishness or empty conceit. Don't think that way. But with humility, and in the Greco-Roman world, they did not regard humility. This is a word that meant to be lowly. They didn't regard that very highly. And I suspect we don't either. Our culture is very much a, you can do it, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, you're the best person, you can live for yourself, you can accomplish it. It's all about me, myself, and I. That's our culture too. But he says, look, think nothing that way, but with humility, with lowliness of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. So the Greek word for humility means to be lowly, poor, or insignificant. It's the opposite of exaggerated self-conception. We are to think about ourselves as lowly in comparison to others. So humility is a comparison word. And we all compare ourselves to other people. We compare ourselves constantly to other people. And usually what we do when we compare ourselves to other people is what? We find those that we can be superior to compare ourselves to. We're selective. Because if we can feel superior to the other people, then we feel good about life. And so we usually compare ourselves in ways that will be favorable to us. Humility says compare yourselves in ways that show you are lowly or insignificant compared to others. Change the value system so that you value others more importantly. So are we higher or lower than others in our thinking? That's why Paul says here that one of the best ways to practice humility is to consciously think of others as more important than ourselves. Now, he's not saying that we are supposed to have some sort of false humility. We're not supposed to think of others as smarter or more talented than us. If we have talents too. We're smart. We have different things. Well, I think we are in different ways. So it's not a falseness here. He's not talking about whether someone is smarter or more talented than someone else. He's talking about value. Is somebody more important or more valuable? That's a totally different thing. That's a mental mindset. When we think this way, we regard others, or we consider others as surpassing ourselves in value or in importance. It's a way of thinking. It is a mental exercise. It is a value judgment. So the problem with our value system is that it is skewed by our own sinfulness, our own selfishness. We naturally value ourselves higher than we value others. I'm right. Yeah, you must be wrong. I mean, that's the way it is. Our pride makes it impossible to see things from the other person's perspective. But if we start thinking with humility, we will value the other person. Whoever it is valuable in God's eyes. And we can value them as more important. And we will start to see things from his or her perspective in the body of Christ, in our marriages, in our relationships. The ability to see things from another person's perspective then changes the whole argument, doesn't it? We step back, we start to listen. Because we value the other person as having a higher value than we value ourselves. And now we're listening. Now, that doesn't mean we agree. We're not talking about agreeing. but we value one another in that process. We may still disagree, but we're going to value each other and have a constructive relationship as a result. That's hard to do, by the way, isn't it? Especially in the heat of the moment, especially when emotions are going full tilt. It's very hard to step back and value the other person. But that's what Paul is talking about here. If we can step back and start to value the other person, we can start to think through the argument more effectively. We may not agree. We may disagree, but we value the other person more than ourselves. And the result is that the relationship is not destroyed even if we don't agree with each other. It all starts with how we value others in our lives. Peter in 1 Peter gives us great advice on this matter of humility. He says in 1 Peter 5, "You younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders, and all of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another." There's that word again. "For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time." See, humility has both a vertical and a horizontal relationship. And it really starts with how we relate to God, you know? If we humble ourselves before God, if we see God as more valuable, more powerful, more important than ourselves, and we're humbling ourselves before God, then we can begin to humble ourselves before men. But if we're fighting God, no way. We're not humbling ourselves before God. We will always struggle with pride in our relationships with other people. And it will be destructive. And that's why we see so many broken families and so many horrible relationships. Fight God, you'll fight others in the end. So he says, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, submit to him, that he may exalt you at the proper time. Leave the exalting to him. And he also gives us some examples of how we treat one another with humility. We live out that humility as we value other people in humility. And a very important test of our humility. Want to know if you're thinking humbly, or if you're living humbly? A very important test is always the test of submission. Am I willing to submit? Or does my pride get in the way of that submission? And so, young men, he says, are told to subject themselves to their elders. Submit. Treat with respect those who are older than you. That's humility. We see this in many areas of our lives. Paul says in Ephesians that wives are to submit to their husbands. That's simple humility. That's all. He also says in Ephesians that that husbands and wives are supposed to submit to one another, right? We're supposed to submit to one another in the church. That's humility. Workers are to submit to bosses, Paul says. That's humility. We are told to submit to one another in the church. That's humility. So humility is rating someone else higher than ourselves. It starts with rating God higher than ourselves, and then it goes on to rating other people higher than ourselves. It's a value system. And the result is healthy relationships. I mean, God made us. He knows how we will work best. And he made us this way, so he knows that if we live this way, we will have healthy relationships. So let God exalt you in his time. Don't worry about fighting for your rights. Let God exalt you. He knows what is best. Don't feed off the flattery of others or you'll have an exaggerated opinion of yourselves, and now you'll go back to the first principle. Hank Ketcham, the cartoonist who created Dennis the Menace, once said, "Flattery is like chewing gum. Enjoy it, but don't swallow it." F.B. Meyer was a very godly pastor and author many years ago, and I like this poem that he wrote. "I used to think," he writes, "that God's gifts were on shelves one above another, and the taller we grow, the easier we can reach them. Now I find that God's gifts are on shelves one beneath another, and the lower we stoop, the more we get." See, it's a total reversal that Christ came to achieve in our relationships. F.B. Meyer also wrote a letter to a friend just a few weeks before his death. He was 82 years old at this point, and he was in a nursing home, but he wanted to share what the Spirit of God was teaching him in recent days there as he was in that nursing home. And he said that he had learned recently that his books, and he wrote lots and lots of books. Some of you probably read some of F.B. Meyer's books. I have. He wrote lots of books. But he said that he had learned recently that his books had given him a reputation for sanctity, for godliness. And he was afraid that the reputation would grow on him, as he put it. And he would become prideful about this. Hey, guy's 82 years old in a nursing home. And he's worried about pride. And then he said these words at the end of his letter, "It makes one want to creep into heaven unnoticed." It makes one want to creep into heaven unnoticed. That's humility. That's the spirit we want to cultivate in our lives. So how we think about ourselves, that can hurt other people. When we value others, that's when we will humble ourselves. And finally, third principle, what we choose to see in others changes us. Verse 4. "Do not merely look out for your own personal interests," Paul writes, "but also for the interests of others." Pastor Andy Stanley in a sermon said that he used to do a lot of marriage counseling. And often one spouse, and all of us who've done these sorts of things end up with some of these situations, often one spouse would come into the office and start ranting and raving, "My husband does this. My wife never will do that." And it would go on and on and on. And he would sit there thinking to himself, and I've had these thoughts too, "This counseling isn't going to be very effective because the person who apparently needs to change isn't even in this room. So how are we going to do anything about it?" So he said he would get a pad of paper, draw a circle on it, and say, "This is a pie that represents all the mess in your marriage. Now, 100% of the blame is in this pie, because that's the whole of it right there. That's where all the mess is." And then he'd give the person a pen or a pencil, and he said, "I would want you to draw a slice of the pie that you think represents your responsibility in the mess." And the piece of pie, the slice that the client would draw, was never very big, you know. It's always this little slice out of the pie. That's my responsibility. My wife is the rest of it, or my husband is the rest of it, you see. And then he would say, "Okay, so why don't you and I talk about just this slice? Let's talk about this piece that's your responsibility. Let's talk about your slice." You know what? He said, "I never could get people to stick to their slice. It never worked. In any relationship like that," he said, "they always want to talk about the other person." So, in any relationship, if you can get the two parties to own their piece of the pie, you make progress. But if everybody is focused on the other person's slice of the pie, you'll just have a mess. Now, in this verse, Paul is not saying focus on all the bad parts of the rest of the pie when he says think about the interests of the other person. He's not talking that way. He's talking about the good slice of the pie. What is good about what is in the other person? We are far too quick to focus on the negatives in life and far too slow to focus on the positives. We are very good at the blame game. We are expert critics of everyone, except ourselves, of course. When we criticize others, we're not looking out for their interests the way Paul is talking about here. We're looking out for our own interests. And if we're looking out for our interests, then we wouldn't be so critical of them. The word interests is actually a bit misleading. First of all, it's not in the Greek text. It's supplied by translators. We have to supply a noun here. Literally, the text says in the Greek, from a literal translation from the Greek, not each one looking out for the blank of themselves, but also looking out for the blank of others. That word is left out. We have to supply it. And the verb means to pay attention or to watch carefully. And it can be translated to contemplate. What are we to contemplate? What are we to watch in others? Not just their interests. Interest doesn't quite get it. It's not just that we're to care about them and whatever they're interested in. We are actually to contemplate something in them as we think. So I would translate this verse this way. Each one not watching for the best qualities of themselves, but also watching for the best qualities of others. Now I've substituted the word quality instead of interest or qualities. I think it gets us to the heart of what Paul is saying here a little bit more. We can make a conscious effort to pay attention to the positive qualities in the pie. And not just the negative qualities. When we watch for, when we contemplate the best qualities in others, it will change us. We won't be so critical. And we will take responsibility for our own negative qualities because we are seeing the positive qualities in the other person. And that's a choice every single one of us can make in every relationship. We can choose to look at the best qualities of someone else and not the worst. Doesn't mean we're going to ignore entirely those things, but we start with that mental attitude. So spouses can choose to see and remember the best qualities in each other. Children can choose to remember the best qualities of their parents. In the church, we can choose to focus on the best qualities we see in each other instead of the best qualities we see just in ourselves. When we focus on our best qualities, then we become critical of others. When we focus on the best qualities of others, it changes us. Darlene was going through the bedtime routine with Micah, her autistic son. And she asked him, as she was preparing him for bed, how many kisses do you want tonight? Well, Micah loved the game. Sometimes it's just one kiss. Sometimes it was 100. But tonight he asked, he asked for one. Suddenly he sat up in bed. We need a record of kisses. He jumped out of bed, went to the small chalkboard, and drew on that chalkboard columns, and he put kisses on there. And then he recorded one small mark. One kiss, he said. We have a record of kisses. Well, his mom was rather moved by all of that, so she started giving him more kisses, right? And each time he'd jump up and mark another mark. Started counting. One, two, three, 13. We have 15 kisses, Mom. And she decided probably he better go to bed, so she stopped smothering him with kisses. She wanted to do more. He needed to sleep. And then as she was leaving the room, she thought of what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13. You know the love chapter? Love keeps no record of wrongs. Love keeps no record of wrongs. She thought, love keeps a record of kisses, the rights. What a difference that makes in our relationships. What are you keeping a record of in your marriage? So often I've found the things that attract us to one another in the first place are the things we will hate about each other later on. What are you keeping track of? What's the record that you're keeping of one another in your marriage? Is it the kisses? Is it the positives or the negatives? What about church? We rub each other. We disagree. What's the record we're keeping? What do we remember about that person? Is it the negatives or the positives? See, if we keep track of all the wrongs, the result is you can never quite get past all those wrongs, right? And so now in the conversation, that's all you know about the wrongs about the other person. And we can't get past those wrongs. Oh, my goodness. It's literally falling apart. There's pieces falling out all over the floor. Okay. Powerful preaching, I don't know. I don't know about that. All right, but if we keep track of the, if we remember the right things, what happens? It changes. I got to stay here, don't I? It changes us. No, we cannot change each other. You cannot change another person. I cannot change another person. I only can deal with myself. So it doesn't change the other person. It changes us in that process because we begin to think differently in the relationship. So love keeps a record of kisses, not of wrongs. Charlotte's Web is a wonderful little children's story. I'm sure you've all read that story by E.B. White about the spider Charlotte and the pig Wilbur. And Wilbur is worried about if he grows fat enough, he's going to be carved up into bacon and ham slices and all of that. So Charlotte and Wilbur develop this close friendship, and as Wilbur grows larger, Charlotte uses all of her resources, of course, to write into the web different things about Wilbur and to promote him, so to speak, as a pig worth saving. The story builds all the way through until the final chapter. Now, in the book version, the final chapter is entitled The Moment of Triumph. The Moment of Triumph. And in that final chapter, as the story draws to a close, Charlotte the spider is in the barn dying. And Wilbur is nearby at the fair, and he is winning applause for being the best pig. And as she listens to the applause, she knows that Wilbur has been saved and that he will not have to die. She finds great joy in that. She finds great joy that her efforts have meant the success of her friend, even though Charlotte is dying and nobody will remember her. And that chapter is entitled The Moment of Triumph. That's her triumph. True success in our relationships, Paul writes, is to help others succeed in life. We win when our spouses do well. We triumph when others do well in the ministry. Love invests in others and rejoices when others do well. Father, Help us to put into practice those lessons, because we get so caught up in ourselves and our positions and our rights that we forget to value others, to love others. And as Christians, those who follow you, Lord, you died to save us, and you have bought us, and we are yours, and you live in us by your Spirit. Help us to put that into practice so that we love one another as you love us. In Jesus' name, amen.